With her brown curls under the white fur hood, he kissed her before he set her back down, and then turned and headed for home with Gauta. Now that Erland had nothing else to occupy him, he was always in the company of a few of his sons. Ulvil took her aunt's hand and walked on a bit. Then she started running again, rushing in between Ivar and Skúla. Yes, she was a beautiful child, but wild and unruly. If they had had a daughter, Erland would have no doubt taken her along and played with her too. At Formo, Simon was alone in the house with his little son when they came in. He was sitting in the high seat in the middle of the long table, looking at Andras. The child was kneeling on the outer bench and playing with several old wooden pegs, trying to make them stand on their heads on the table. As soon as Ulvild saw this, she forgot about greeting her father. She climbed right up onto the bench next to her brother, grabbed him by the back of the neck, and pounded his face against the table while she screamed that they were her pegs. Father had given them to her. Simon stood up to separate the children. Then he happened to knock over a little pottery dish standing near his elbow. It fell to the floor and shattered. Arnyard crawled under the table and gathered up the pieces. Simon took them from her and looked at them, greatly dismayed. "Your mother is going to be angry." It was a pretty little flower-painted dish made of shiny white ceramic that Sir Andres Dara had brought home from France. Simon explained that Helga had inherited it, but she had given it to Romborg. The women considered it a great treasure. At that moment, he heard his wife out in the entryway, and he hid his hands, holding the pottery shards, behind his back. Romborg came in and greeted her sister and nephews. She took off Ulvild's cloak, and the maiden ran over to her father and clung to him. "Look how fine you are today, Ulvil. I see that you're wearing your silver belt on a work day." But he couldn't hug the child because his hands were full. Ulvil shouted that she had been visiting her aunt Kristen at Jurengard. That was why mother had dressed her so nicely in the morning. "Yes, your mother keeps you dressed so splendid and grand. They could set you up on the shrine on the north side of the church the way you look," said Simon, smiling. The only work Romborg ever did was to sew garments for her daughter. Ulvild was always magnificently clothed. "Why are you standing there like that?" Romborg asked her husband. Simon showed her the pottery pieces. "I don't know what you're going to say about this." Romborg took them from him. "You didn't have to stand there looking like such a fool because of this." Kristen felt ill at ease as she sat there. It was true that Simon had looked quite ridiculous as he stood there hiding the broken pieces in such a childish manner. But Romborg didn't need to mention it. "I expected you to be mad because your dish was broken," said her husband.
"Yes, you always seem to be so afraid that something will make me mad, and something so frivolous," replied Romborg,
and the others saw that she was close to tears. "You know quite well, Romborg, that's not the only way I act," said Simon. "And it's not just frivolous things either."
"I wouldn't know," replied his wife in the same tone of voice. "It has never been your habit, Simon, to talk to me about important matters."
She turned on her heel and walked toward the entryway. Simon stood still for a moment, staring after her. When he sat down, his son Andres came over and wanted to climb onto his father's lap. Simon picked him up and sat there with his chin resting on the child's head, but he didn't seem to be listening to the boy's chatter. After a while, Kristen ventured, a little hesitantly, "Romborg isn't so young anymore, Simon. Your oldest child is already 7 winters old."
"What do you mean?" asked Simon.
And it seemed to her that his voice was unnecessarily sharp.
"I mean nothing more than that perhaps my sister thinks you find her too young to... Maybe if you could try to let her take charge of things more here on the estate, together with you."
"My wife takes charge of as much as she likes," replied Simon heatedly. "I don't demand that she do more than she wants to do, but I've never refused to allow Romborg to manage anything here at Formo. If you think otherwise, then it's because you don't know."
No, said Kristen. But it has seemed to me, brother-in-law, that now and then you don't consider Romborg to be any older than when you married her. You should remember, Simon. You should remember.
He set the child down and jumped to his feet, that Romborg and I came to an agreement. You and I never could.
His wife came into the room at that moment, carrying a container of ale for the guests. Simon quickly went over to her and placed his hand on her shoulder.
Did you hear that, Romborg? Your sister is standing here saying that she doesn't think you're happy with your lot. He laughed.
Romborg looked up. Her big, dark eyes glittered strangely.
Why is that? I got what I wanted, just as you did, Kristen. If we two sisters can't be happy, then I don't know.
And she too laughed. Kristen stood there, flushed and angry. She refused to accept the ale bowl.
No, it's already late. Time for us to head back home now.
And she looked around for her sons.
Oh no, Kristen.
Simon took the bowl from his wife and drank a toast.
Don't be angry. You shouldn't take so much to heart every word that falls between the closest kin. Sit down for a while and rest your feet, and be good enough to forget it if I've spoken to you in any way that I shouldn't have.
Then he said,
I'm tired.
And he stretched and yawned. He asked how far they had gotten with the spring farm work at Urengard. Here at Formo, they had plowed up all the fields north of the manor road. Kristen left as soon as she thought it was seemly.
No, Simon didn't need to accompany her, she said when he picked up his hooded cape and axe. She had her big sons with her.
But he insisted, and also asked Romborg to walk along with them, at least up through the fenced fields. She didn't usually agree to this, but tonight she went with them all the way up to the road. Outdoors, the night was black and clear with glittering stars. The faint, warm, and pleasant smell of newly manured fields gave a springtime odor to the night frost. The sound of water was everywhere in the darkness around them. Simon and Kristen walked north. The three boys ran on ahead. She could sense that the man at her side wanted to say something, but she didn't feel like making it easier for him because she was still quite furious. Of course she was fond of her brother-in-law, but there had to be a limit to what he could say and then brush aside afterward, as merely something between kinsmen. He had to realize that because he had stood by them so loyally during their troubles, it wasn't easy for her when he grew quick-tempered or rude. It was difficult for her to take him to task. She thought about the first winter, not long after they had arrived in the village. Romborg had sent for her because Simon lay in bed with boils in his throat and was terribly ill. He suffered from this ailment now and then. But when Kristen arrived at Formo and went in to see the man, he refused to allow her to touch him or even look at him. He was so irate that Romborg, greatly distressed, begged her sister's forgiveness for asking her to come. Simon had not been any kinder toward her, she said, the first time he fell ill after they were married and she tried to nurse him. Whenever he had throat boils, he would retreat to the old building they called the Simon House, and he couldn't stand to have anyone near him except for a horrid, filthy, and lice-ridden old man named Gunstein, who had served Diefrin since before Simon was born. Later, Simon would no doubt come to see his sister-in-law to make amends. He didn't want anyone to see him when he was ill like that. He thought it such a pitiful shortcoming for a full-grown man. Kristen had replied, rather crossly, that she didn't understand. It was neither sinful nor shameful to suffer from throat boils. Simon accompanied her all the way up to the bridge, and as they walked, they exchanged only a few words about the weather and the farm work, repeating things they had already said back at the house. Simon said good night, but then he asked abruptly, Do you know, Kristen, how I might have offended Gaute that the boy should be so angry with me?
Gaute? She said in surprise.
Yes, haven't you noticed? He avoids me, but if he can't help meeting me, he barely opens his mouth when I speak to him.
Kristen shook her head. No, she hadn't noticed.
Unless you said something in jest and he took it wrong, child that he is.
He heard in her voice that she was smiling. Then he laughed a bit and said, "But I can't remember anything of the sort." And with that, he again bade her good night and left. It was completely quiet at Urengard. The main house was dark, with the ashes raked over the fire in the hearth. Björgulf was awake and said that his father and brothers had left some time ago. Over in the master's bed, Munan was sleeping alone. Kristin took him in her arms after she lay down. It was so difficult to talk about it to Erland when he didn't seem to realize himself that he shouldn't take the older boys and run off with them into the woods when there was more than enough work to be done on the estate. That Erland himself should walk behind a plow was not something she had ever expected. He probably wouldn't be able to do a proper job of it either. And Ulf wouldn't like it much if Erland interfered in the running of the farm. But her sons could not grow up in the same way as their father had been allowed to do, learning to use weapons, hunting animals, and amusing himself with his horses or poring over a chessboard with a priest who would slyly attempt to cajole the knight's son into acquiring a little knowledge of Latin and writing, of singing and the playing of stringed instruments. She had so few servants on the estate because she thought that her sons should learn even as children that they would have to become accustomed to farm work. It now looked doubtful that there would be any knighthood for Erland's sons. But Gaute was the only one of the boys who had any inclination for farming. Gaute was a hard worker, but he was 13 years old, and it could only be expected that he would rather go with his father when Erland came and invited him to come along. It was difficult to talk to Erland about this, because it was Kristen's firm resolve that her husband should never hear from her a single word that he might perceive as a criticism of his behavior, or a complaint over the fate that he had brought upon himself and his sons. That meant it wasn't easy to make the father understand that his sons had to get used to doing the work themselves on their estate. If only Ulf would speak of it, she thought. When they moved the livestock from the spring pastures up to Hovringen, Kristin went along up to the mountains. She didn't want to take the twins with her. They would soon be 11 years old, and they were the most unruly and willful of her children. It was even harder for her to handle them because the two boys stuck together in everything. If she managed to get Ivar alone, he was good and obedient enough, but Skúla was hot-tempered and stubborn. And when the brothers were together, Ivar said and did everything that Skúla demanded. Chapter 2. One day early in the fall, Kristin went outside about the time of mid-afternoon prayers. The herdsman had said that a short distance down the mountainside, if she followed the riverbed, there was supposed to be an abundance of mulleins on a cleared slope. Kristin found the spot, a steep incline baking in the direct glare of the sun. It was the very best time for picking the flowers. They grew in thick clumps over the heaps of stones and around the gray stubble. Tall, pale yellow stalks, richly adorned with small open stars. Kristin set Munan to picking raspberries in among some brushwood, from which he wouldn't be able to escape without her help. She told the dog to stay with him and keep watch. Then she took out her knife and began cutting mulleins, constantly casting an eye at the little child. Lavrun stayed at her side and cut flowers too. She was always fearful for her two small children in the mountains. Otherwise, she was not afraid of the people up there anymore. Many had already gone home from the pastures, but she was thinking of staying until after the feast of the birth of Mary. It was pitch black at night now, and vile when the wind blew hard. Vile if they had to go outside late at night. But the weather had been so fine up in the heights, while down below, the countryside was parched this year, and the grazing was poor. The men would have to stay up in the mountains during both the late fall and winter. But her father had said that he had never noticed anyone haunting their high pastures during the winter. Kristin stopped under a solitary spruce tree in the middle of the hillside. She stood with her hands wrapped around the heavy weight of the flower stalks that were draped over her arm. From here, she could look northward and see halfway to Dovre. In many places, the grain was gathered in shocks in the fields. The hillsides were yellow and sun-scorched over there, too. But it was never truly green here in the valley, she thought. Not as green as in Trøndelag. Yes. She longed for the home they had had there, the manor that stood so high and magnificent on the broad breast of the ridge, with fields and meadows spreading out all around, extending below to the cluster of leafy woods that sloped down toward the lake at the bottom of the valley. The vast view across low forested hills that undulated, wave upon wave, south toward the Dovre Range. And the lush meadows so thick and tall in the summer, red with crimson flowers beneath the red evening sky, the second crop of hay so succulent and green in the autumn. Yes, sometimes she even felt a longing for the fjord, the skerries of Byrgsey, the docks with the boats and ships, the boathouses, the smell of tar and fishing nets in the sea, all those things she had disliked so much when she first went north. Erlan must be longing for that smell, and for the sea and the sea wind. She missed everything that she had once found so wearisome. All the housekeeping, the scores of servants, the clamor of Erlan's men as they rode into the courtyard with clanging weapons and jangling harnesses, the strangers who came and went, bringing them great news from all over the land and gossip about people in the town and countryside. Now she realized how quiet her life had become when all this had been silenced. Nidaros with its churches and cloisters and banquets at the great estates in town. She longed to walk through the streets with her own serving man and maid accompanying her, to climb the loft stairs to the merchants' shops, to choose and reject wares, to step aboard the boats on the river to buy goods, English linen hats, elegant shawls, wooden horses with riders that would thrust out their lances if you pulled a string. She thought about the meadows outside town near Nidaride, where she used to walk with her children, looking at the trained dogs and bears of the wandering minstrels, buying gingerbread and walnuts. And there were times when she longed to dress in her finery again. A silk shift and a delicate fine wimple. The sleeveless surcoat made of pale blue velvet that Erland had bought for her the winter before the misfortune befell them. It was edged with marten fur along the deep cut of the bodice and around the wide armholes, which reached all the way down to her hips, revealing the belt underneath. And occasionally she longed for... Oh no, she should be sensible and happy about that. Happy as long as she was free from having any more children. When she fell ill this autumn after the great slaughtering, it was best that it happened that way. But she had wept a little, those first few nights afterward. It seemed an eternity since she had held an infant. Munan was only 4 winters old, but she had been forced to give him into the care of strangers before he was even a year. When he came back to her, he could already walk and talk, and he didn't know her. Erlan. Oh, Erlan. Deep in her heart, she knew that he wasn't as nonchalant as he seemed. This man who was always restless. Now he seemed always so calm. Like a stream that finally runs up against a steep cliff and lets itself be diverted, trickling out into the peat to become a calm pool with marshlands all around. He wandered about Uringard, doing nothing, and then he would find one or another of his sons to keep him company in his idleness. Or he would go out hunting with them. Once in a while, he would go off to tar and repair one of the fishing boats they kept at the lake. Or he would set about breaking in one of the young colts, although he never had much success. He was far too impatient. He kept to himself and pretended not to notice that no one sought out his company. His sons followed their father's example. They were not well liked, these outsiders who had been driven to the valley by misfortune and who still went about like proud strangers, never inquiring about the customs of the region or its people. Ulf Haldorsson was outright despised. He was openly scornful of the inhabitants of the valley, calling them stupid and old-fashioned. People who hadn't grown up near the sea weren't proper folks at all. As for Kristin herself, she knew that she didn't have many friends here in her own valley either. Not anymore. She straightened her back in the peat-brown homespun dress, shading her eyes with her hand against the golden flood of afternoon sunlight. To the north, she caught a glimpse of the valley along the pale green ribbon of the river, and then the crush of mountainous shapes, one after the other, grayish-yellow with scree and moss-covered plateaus. Toward the center, snowdrifts and clouds melded into one another in the passes and ravines. Right across from her, the Roast Range jutted out its knee, closing off the valley. The Logue River had to bend its course. A distant roar reached her from the river, which cut deep through the rocky cliffs below and tumbled in a roiling froth from ledge to ledge. Just beyond the mossy slopes at the top of the range towered the two enormous blue peaks, which her father had compared to a woman's breasts. Erland must think this place hemmed in and hideous, find it difficult to breathe. It was a little farther to the south, on this same hillside, but closer to the familiar slopes, that she had seen the elf maiden when she was a small child. A gentle, soft, pretty child, with lush silken hair framing her round, pink and white cheeks. Kristen closed her eyes and turned her sunburned face up toward the flood of light. A young mother, her breasts bursting with milk, her heart churned up and fecund like a newly plowed field after the birth of her child. Yes. But with someone like herself, there should be no danger. They wouldn't even try to lure her inside. No doubt the Mountain King would find the bridal gold ill-suited to such a gaunt and worn-out woman. The wood nymph would have no desire to place her child at Kristen's withered teats. She felt hard and dry, like the spruce root under her foot that curved around stones and clung to the ground. Abruptly, she dug her heel into the root. The two little boys who had come over to their mother rushed to do as she did, kicking the tree root with all their might and then asking eagerly, "Why are you doing that, Mother?" Kristen sat down, placed the mullens in her lap, and began tearing off the open blossoms to put in the basket. "Because my shoe was pinching my toes," she replied so much later that the boys had forgotten what they had asked. But this didn't bother them. They were used to the way their mother seemed not to listen when they spoke to her, or the way she would wake up and give an answer after they had long forgotten their own question. Lavrans helped tear off the flowers. Munan wanted to help too, but he merely shredded the tufts. Then Kristen took the mullens away from him without a word, showing no anger, completely absorbed in her own thoughts. After a while, the boys began playing and fighting with the bare stalks that she had cast aside. They were making a loud ruckus next to her knee. Kristen looked at the two small, round heads with brown hair. They still looked much alike. Their hair was the same light brown color, but from various faint little traits and hastily glimpsed signs, their mother could tell they would grow up to be quite different. Munan was going to look like his father. He had those pale blue eyes and such silky hair, which curled in thick, soft tendrils on his narrow head. It would grow as dark as soot with time. His little face was still so round in the chin and cheeks that it was a pleasure to cup her hands around its tender freshness. His face would become thin and lean when he grew older. He would also have the high, narrow forehead with hollowed temples and the straight, jutting triangle of a nose that was narrow and sharp across the ridge, with thin, flaring nostrils, just as Nokva already had, and the twins clearly showed signs of having too. Lavrans had had flaxen, curly hair as fine as silk when he was small. Now it was the color of a hazelnut, but it gleamed like gold in the sun. It was quite straight and still soft enough, although somewhat coarser and heavier than before, close and thick when she buried her fingers in it. Lavrans looked like Kristen. He had gray eyes and a round face with a broad forehead and a softly rounded chin. He would probably retain his pink and white complexion long after he became a man. Gauta, too, had that fresh coloring. He looked so much like her father, with a long, full face, iron gray eyes, and pale blonde hair. Björgulf was the only one in whom she could see no resemblance. He was the tallest of her sons, with broad shoulders and heavy, strong limbs. Curly locks of raven black hair fell low over his broad white forehead. His eyes were blue-black, but oddly without luster, and he squinted badly when he looked up. She didn't know when he had actually started doing this, because he was the child to whom she had always paid the least attention. They took him away from her and gave him to a foster mother right after his birth. 11 months later, she had Gauta, and Gauta had been in poor health during the first 4 years of his life. After the birth of the twins, she had gotten out of bed, still ailing and with a pain in her back, and resumed caring for the older child, carrying him around and tending to him. She barely had time to look at the two new children, except when Frida brought her Ivar, who was crying and thirsty. And Gauta would lie there screaming while she sat and nursed the infant. She hadn't had the strength. Blessed Virgin Mary, you know that I couldn't manage to pay more attention to Björgulf. And he preferred to keep to himself and do things alone, solitary and quiet as he always had been. He never seemed to like it when she caressed him. She had thought he was the strongest of her children. A young, stubborn, dark bull is how she thought of him. Gradually she realized that his eyesight was quite poor. The monks had done something for his eyes when he and Nokva were at Tautra, but it hadn't seemed to help. He continued to be taciturn. It did no good for her to try to draw Björgulf closer. She saw that he was just the same with his father. Björgulf was the only one of their sons who didn't warm to Erland's attention the way a meadow receives the sunlight. Only toward Nokva was Björgulf any different, but when Kristin tried to talk to Nokva about his brother, he refused to say anything. She wondered whether Erland had any better luck in those quarters, since Nokva's love for Erland was so great. Oh no, Erland's offspring readily bore witness to who their father was. She had seen that child from Lensvik when she was in Nidaros the last time. She had met Sir Bard in the Christchurch courtyard. He was coming out the door, accompanied by many men and women and servants. A maid carried the swaddled infant. Bard Oslofsson greeted Kristin with a nod of his head, silent and courteous as they walked past her. His wife was not with him. She had seen the child's face, just a single glance. But that was enough. He looked like the tiny infant faces that she had held to her own breast. Arne Javaldsson was with her, and he couldn't keep from talking. That's just the way he was. Sir Bard's other heirs were not pleased when the child was born the previous winter, but Bard had him baptized Osulf. Between Erland Nikolausson and Fru Suniva, there had never been any other friendship than what everyone knew. That's what Bard claimed never to doubt. Indiscreet and reckless as Erland was, he had probably let too much slip when he was bantering with Suniva, and it was nothing more than her duty to warn the king's envoys when she became suspicious. But if they had been too friendly, then Suniva must have also known that her brother was involved in Erland's plans. When Hoftor Grout took his own life and forfeited his salvation in prison, she was greatly distraught. No one could know how much she blamed herself during that time. Sir Bard had placed his hand on the hilt of his sword and stared at everyone as he spoke of this, said Arna. Arna had also mentioned the matter to Erlan. One day when Kristin was up in one of the lofts, the men were standing beneath the gallery, unaware that she could hear their conversation. The Lensvik knight was overjoyed about the son his wife had given birth to the winter before. He never doubted that he himself was the father. Yes, well, Bard must know best about that, Erland had replied. She knew that tone of voice of his. Now he would be standing there with lowered eyes and a little smile tugging at the corner of his mouth. Sir Bard bore such rancor toward his kinsmen who would have been his heirs if he had died childless. But people were now saying this was unfair. Well, the man himself must know best, said Erland again. Yes, yes, Erland. But that boy is going to inherit more than the 7 sons you have with your wife. I will provide for my 7 sons, Arna. Then Kristin went downstairs. She couldn't bear to hear them talk any more about this subject. Erland was a little startled when he saw her. Then he went over and took her hand, standing behind her so that her shoulder touched his body. She understood that as he stood there, gazing down at her, he was repeating without words what he had just affirmed, as if he wanted to give her strength. Kristen became aware that Monan was staring up at her a bit anxiously. She had apparently smiled, though not in a pleasant way. But when his mother looked down at him, the boy smiled back, hesitant and uncertain. Impetuously, she pulled him onto her lap. He was little, little, still so little, her youngest, not too big to be kissed and caressed by his mother. She winked one eye at him. He wanted to wink back, but try as he might, both his eyes kept winking. His mother laughed loudly, and then Monan laughed too, chortling as Kristen hugged him in her arms. Lavrans had been sitting with a dog on his lap. They both turned toward the woods to listen.
It's father!
First the dog and then the boy bounded down the steep slope. Kristen stayed where she was for a moment. Then she stood up and walked forward to the precipice. Now they appeared on the path below, Erlan, Nokva, Ivar, and Skule. They shouted greetings up to her, merry and boisterous. Kristen greeted them in return. Were they on their way up to get the horses? No, Erlan replied. Ulf planned to send Sveinbjörn after them that evening. He and Nokva were off to hunt reindeer, and the twins had wanted to come along to see her. She didn't reply. She had realized this even before she asked. Nokva had a dog on a tether. He and his father were dressed in gray and black dappled homespun tunics that were hard to see against the scree. All four were carrying bows. Kristen asked about news from the manor, and Erlan chatted as they climbed upward. Ulf was in the midst of the grain harvesting. He seemed pleased enough, but the hay was stunted, and the grain in the rest of the fields had ripened too early in the drought. It was falling off the stalks. And the oats would soon be ready to harvest. Ulf said they would have to work fast. Kristen walked along, nodding, without saying a word. She went to the cowshed herself to do the milking. She usually enjoyed the time she sat in the dark next to the bulging flank of the cow, smelling the sweet breath of the milk as it reached her nose. A spurting sound echoed from the darkness where the milkmaid and herdsmen were milking. It created such a calm feeling, the strong, warm smell of the shed, the creaking sounds of the osier door hasps, horns butting against wood, a cow shifting her hooves in the soft muck of the floor and swatting her tail at the flies. The wagtails that had made their nests inside during the summer were gone now. The cows were restless tonight. Blue Side set her foot down in the milk pail. Kristen gave her a slap and scolded her. The next cow began acting refractory as soon as Kristen moved over to her side. She had sores on her udder. Kristen took off her wedding ring and milked the first spurts through the ring. She heard Ivar and Skule down by the gate. They were shouting and throwing stones at the strange bull that always followed her cows in the evening. They had offered to help Finn milk the goats in the pen, but they had soon grown bored. A little later, when Kristen walked up the hill, they were teasing the pretty white calf that she had given to Lavrans, who was standing nearby and whimpering. She put down her pails, seized the two boys by the shoulder, and flung them aside. They should leave the calf alone if their brother, who was its owner, told them to do so. Erland and Nokva were sitting on the doorstep. They had a fresh cheese between them, and they were eating sliver after sliver as they fed some to Munan, who was standing between Nokva's knees. He had put her horsehair sieve on the little boy's head, saying that now Munan would be invisible, because it wasn't really a sieve, but a wood nymph's hat. All three of them laughed, but as soon as Nokva saw his mother, he handed her the sieve, stood up, and took the milk pails from her. Kristen lingered in the dairy shed. The upper half of the door stood open to the outer room of the hut. They had plenty of wood on the hearth. In the warm, flickering glow, they sat around the fire and ate, Erlan, the children, her maid, and the three herdsmen. By the time she came in, they had finished eating. She saw that the two youngest had been put to bed on the bench along the wall. They were already asleep. Erlend had crawled up into the bed. She stumbled over his outer garments and boots and picked them up as she walked past and then went outside. The sky was still light, with a red stripe above the mountains to the west. Several dark wisps of cloud hovered in the clear air. It looked as if they would have fair weather the next day, too, since it was so calm and biting cold now that night had begun to fall. No wind, but an icy gust from the north, a steady breath from the bare gray slopes. Above the hills to the southeast, the moon was rising, nearly full, huge, and still a pale crimson in the slight haze that always lingered over the marshes in that direction. Somewhere up on the plateau, the strange ox was bellowing and carrying on. Otherwise, it was so quiet that it hurt. Only the roar of the river from below their pasture, the little trickling creek on the slope, and a languid murmuring in the woods, a rustling through the boughs as they moved, paused for a moment, and then moved again. She busied herself with some milk pans and trenchers that stood next to the wall of the hut. Nokfa and the twins came out, and their mother asked them where they were going. They were going to sleep in the barn. There was such a foul smell in the dairy shed from all the cheeses and butter and from the goats that slept inside. Nokfa didn't go to the barn at once. His mother could still see his pale gray figure against the green darkness of the hayfield down at the edge of the woods. A little later, the maid appeared in the doorway. She gave a start when she saw her mistress standing near the wall. "Shouldn't you go to bed now, Astrid? It's getting late." The maid muttered that she just had to go behind the cowshed. Kristen waited until she saw the girl go back inside. Nokfa was now in his 16th year. It was some time ago that his mother had begun keeping an eye on the serving maids on the manor whenever they flirted with the handsome and lively young boy. Kristen walked down to the river and knelt on a rock protruding out over the water. Before her, the river flowed almost black into a wide pool, with only a few rings betraying the current. But a short distance above, it gushed white in the darkness, with a great roar and cold gusts of air. By now the moon had risen so high that it shone brightly. It glittered here and there on a dewy leaf. Its rays caught on a ripple in the stream. Erlan called her name from right behind her. She hadn't heard him come down the slope. Kristen dipped her arm in the icy water and fished up a couple of milk pans weighted with stones that were being rinsed by the river. She got to her feet and followed her husband back, with both her hands full. They didn't speak as they clambered upward. Inside the hut, Erlend undressed completely and climbed into bed.
"Aren't you coming to bed soon, Kristen?"
"I'm just going to have a little food first."
She sat down on her stool next to the hearth with some bread and a slice of cheese in her lap. She ate slowly, staring at the embers, which gradually grew dark in the stone-rimmed hollow in the floor.
"Are you asleep, Erlend?"
she whispered as she stood up and shook out her skirt.
"No."
Kristen went over and drank a ladleful of curdled milk from the basin in the corner. Then she went back to the hearth, lifted a stone, and laid it down flat, sprinkling the mullein blossoms on top to dry. But then she could find no more tasks to do. She undressed in the dark and lay down in the bed next to Erlend. When he put his arms around her, she felt weariness wash over her body like a cold wave. Her head felt empty and heavy, as if everything inside it had sunk down and settled like a knot of pain in the back of her neck. But when he whispered to her, she dutifully put her arms around his neck. She woke up and didn't know what time of night it was. But through the transparent hide stretched over the smoke vent, she could see that the moon must still be high. The bed was short and cramped, so they had to lie close to each other. Erlend was asleep, breathing quietly and evenly, his chest moving faintly as he slept. In the past, she used to move closer to his warm, healthy body when she woke up in the night and grew frightened that he was breathing so silently. Back then, she thought it so blissfully sweet to feel his breast rise and fall as he slept at her side. After a while, she slipped out of bed, got dressed in the dark, and crept out the door. The moon was sailing high over the world. The moss glistened with water, and the rocky cliffs gleamed where streams had trickled during the day. Now they had turned to ice. Up on the plateaus, frost glittered. It was bitterly cold. Kristen crossed her arms over her breasts and stood still for a moment. Then she set off along the creek. It murmured and gurgled with the tiny sounds of ice crystals breaking apart. At the top of the meadow, a huge boulder rose up out of the earth. No one ever went near it unless they had to, and then they would be certain to cross themselves. People poured cream under it whenever they went past. Otherwise, she had never heard that anyone had ever witnessed anything there, but such had been the custom in that pasture ever since ancient times. She didn't know what had come over her that she would leave the house this way, in the middle of the night. She stopped at the boulder and set her foot in a crevice. Her stomach clenched tight. Her womb felt cold and empty with fear, but she refused to make the sign of the cross. Then she climbed up and sat on top of the rock. From up there, she could see a long, long way, far into the ugly, bare mountains in the moonlight. The great dome near Dovre rose up, enormous and pale against the pale sky. Snowdrifts gleamed white in the pass on the gray peaks. The Boar Range glistened with new snow and blue clefts. The mountains in the moonlight were more hideous than she could have imagined. Only a few stars shone here and there in the vast icy sky. She was frozen to the very marrow and bone. Terror and cold pressed in on her from all sides. But defiantly she stayed where she was. She refused to get down and lie in the pitch dark next to the warm, slumbering body of her husband. She could tell that for her there would be no more sleep that night. As sure as she was her father's daughter, her husband would never hear his wife reproach his actions, for she remembered what she had promised when she beseeched the Almighty God and all the saints in heaven to spare Erlan's life. That was why she had come out into this troll night to breathe when she felt about to suffocate. She sat there and let the old, bitter thoughts rise up like good friends, countering them with other old and familiar thoughts, in feigned justification of Erlan. He had certainly never demanded this of her. He had not asked her to bear any of the things she had taken upon her own shoulders. He had merely conceived 7 sons with her. "I will provide for my 7 sons, Arna." God only knew what Erland had meant by those words. Maybe he meant nothing. It was simply something he had said. Erland hadn't asked her to restore order to Husabi and his other estates. He hadn't asked her to fight with her life to save him. He had borne it like a chieftain that his property would be dispersed, that his life was at stake, and that he would lose everything he owned. Stripped and empty-handed, with chieftain-like dignity and calm, he had accepted the misfortune. With chieftain-like calm and dignity, he lived on her father's manor like a guest. And yet everything that was in her possession lawfully belonged to her sons. They lawfully owned her sweat and blood and all her strength. But then surely she and the estate had the right to make claims on them. She hadn't needed to flee to the mountain pastures like some kind of poor leaseholder's wife. But the situation was such at home that she felt pressed and hemmed in from all sides, until she felt as if she couldn't breathe. Then she had felt the need to prove to herself that she could do the work of a peasant woman. She had toiled and labored every hour and every day since she had arrived at the estate of Erlan Nikolausen as his bride, and realized that someone there would have to fight to protect the inheritance of the one she carried under her heart. If the father couldn't do it, then she must. But now she needed to be certain. For that matter, she had demonstrated before to her nursemaids and servant women that there wasn't any kind of work she wasn't capable of doing with her own hands. It was a good day up here if she didn't feel an ache in her flanks from standing and churning. It felt good in the morning when she would go along to let out the cattle. The animals had grown fat and glossy in the summer. The tight grip on her heart eased when she stood in the sunset and called to the cows coming home. She liked to see food growing under her own hands. It felt as if she were reaching down into the very foundation from which the future of her sons would be rebuilt. Jorungarde was a good estate, but it was not as good as she had thought. And Ulf was a stranger here in the valley. He made mistakes, and he grew impatient. As people saw it in the region, they always had plenty of hay at Jorungarde. They had the hay meadows along the river and out on the islands, but it wasn't good hay, not the kind that Ulf was used to in Trøndelag. He wasn't used to having to gather so much moss and foliage, heath and brushwood, as they did here. Her father had known every patch of his land. He had possessed all the farmer's knowledge about the whims of the seasons and the way each particular strip of field handled rain or drought, windy summers or hot summers, about livestock that he himself had bred, raised, foddered, and sold from, generation after generation. The very sort of knowledge that was needed here. She did not have that kind of knowledge of her estate. But she would acquire it, and her sons would too. And yet Erlend had never demanded this of her. He hadn't married her in order to lead her into toil and travail. He had married her so she could sleep in his arms. Then, when her time came, the child lay at her side, demanding a place on her arm, at her breast, in her care. Kristen moaned through clenched teeth. She was shivering with cold and anger. Pactum serva. In Norwegian it means, keep thy faith. That was back when Arne Jalvaldsen and his brother Leif of Holm had come to Huseby to take her possessions and the children's belongings to Nidaros. This too Erlend had left for her to handle. He had taken lodgings at the monastery at Holm. She was staying at their residence in town, now owned by the monks, and Arne Jalvaldsen was with her, helping her in word and deed. Simon had sent him letters about it. Arne could not have been more zealous if he had been trying to salvage the goods for himself. On the evening he arrived in town with everything, he wanted both Kristen and Fru Gunna of Rosvold, who had come to Nidaros with the two small boys, to come out to the stable. 7 splendid horses. People wanted to be fair with Erlend Nikolausen, and they agreed to Arne's claim that the 5 oldest boys each owned a horse and that one belonged to the mistress herself and one to her personal servant. He could testify that Erlend had given the Castilian, his Spanish stallion, to his son Nikolaus, even though this had been done mostly in jest. Not that Arne thought much of the long-legged animal, but he knew that Erlend was fond of the stallion. Arne thought it a shame to lose the magnificent armor with the great helmet and gold-chased sword. It was true that these things were of real use only in a tournament, but they were worth a great deal of money. But he had managed to keep Erlend's coat of mail made of black silk with the embroidered red lion, and he had demanded his English armor for Nikolaus. It was so splendid that Arne didn't think its equal could be found in all of Norway, at least to those who knew how to see, although it was in disrepair. Erlend had used his weapons far more than most sons of noblemen at the time. Arne caressed each piece, the helmet, shoulder collar, the leather arm and leg coverings, the steel gloves made of the finest plates, the corselet and skirt made of rings, so light and comfortable and yet so strong. And the sword. It had only a plain steel hilt, and the leather of the handle was worn. But the likes of such a blade were rarely seen. Kristen sat and held the sword across her lap. She knew that Erlend would embrace it like a much-loved betrothed. It was the only one he had used of all the swords he owned. He had inherited it in his early youth from Sigmund Thorolfsson, who had been his bedmate when he first joined the king's retainers. Only once had Erlend ever mentioned this friend of his to Kristen. If God had not been so hasty to take Sigmund away from this world, many things would have doubtless been different for me. After his death, I was so unhappy at the royal palace that I managed to beg permission from King Håkon to go north with Gisurgale that time,
But then I might never have won you, my dear. Then I probably would have been a married man for many years before you were a grown maiden. From Munan Bardson, she had heard that Erland nursed his friend day and night, the way a mother cares for her child, getting no more sleep than short naps at the bedside of the ailing man during that last winter when Sigmund Thorolfsson lay vomiting up bits of his heart's blood and lungs. And after Sigmund was buried at Hallvard Church, Erland had constantly visited his grave, lying prostrate on the gravestone to grieve. But to Kristin, he had mentioned the man only once. She and Erland had arranged to meet several times in Hallvard Church during that sinful winter in Oslo. But he had never told her that his dearest friend from his youth lay buried there. She knew he had mourned his mother in the same way, and he had been quite frantic with grief when Orm died. But he never spoke of them. Kristin knew that he had gone into town to see Margaret, but he never mentioned his daughter. Up near the hilt, she noticed that some words had been etched into the blade. Most of them were runes, which she couldn't read, nor could Arna. But the monk picked up the sword and studied it for a moment. "Pactum serva," he said finally. "In Norwegian, it means keep thy faith." Arna and his brother Leif talked about the fact that a large part of Kristen's properties in the north, Erland's wedding gifts to her, had been mortgaged and dispersed. They wondered whether there was any way to salvage part of them. But Kristen refused. Honor was the most important thing to salvage. She didn't want to hear of any disputes over whether her husband's dealings had been lawful. And she was deadly tired of Arna's chatter, no matter how well-intentioned it was. That evening, when he and the monk bade her goodnight and went to their sleeping chambers, Kristin had thrown herself to her knees before Fru Gunna and buried her head in her lap. After a moment, the old woman lifted her face. Kristin looked up. Fru Gunna's face was heavy, yellowish, and stout, with three deep creases across her forehead, as if shaped out of wax. She had pale freckles, sharp and kind blue eyes, and a sunken, toothless mouth shadowed by long gray whiskers. Kristin had had that face above her so many times. Fru Gunna had been at her side each time she gave birth, except when Lavrans was born and she was at home to attend her father's deathbed. "Yes, yes, my daughter," said the woman, putting her hands at Kristen's temples. "I've given you help a few times when you had to sink to your knees, yes, I have. But in this trouble, my Kristin, you must kneel down before the Mother of God and ask her to help you through." Oh, she had already done that too, thought Kristin. She had said her prayers and read some of the Gospels every Saturday. She had observed the fast days as Archbishop Eilev had enjoined her to do when he granted her absolution. She gave alms and personally served every wanderer who asked for shelter, no matter how he might look. But now she no longer felt any light inside her when she did so. She knew that the light outside did exist, but it felt as if shutters had closed her off inside. That must be what Gunnulf had spoken of, spiritual drought. Sira Eiliv said that was why no soul should lose courage. Remain faithful to your prayers and good deeds, the way the farmer plows and spreads manure and sows. God would send the good weather for growing when it was time. But Sira Eiliv had never managed a farm himself. She had not seen Gunnulf during that time. He was living north in Helgeland, preaching and collecting gifts for the monastery. Well, yes, that was one of the knight's sons from Husaby, while the other... But Margaret Erland's daughter came to visit Kristin several times at the town residence. Two maids accompanied the merchant's wife. She was beautifully dressed and glittering with jewelry. Her father-in-law was a goldsmith, so they had plenty of jewelry at home. She seemed happy and content, although she had no children. She had received her inheritance from her father just in time. God only knew if she ever gave any thought to that poor cripple Håkon out at Gimsar. He could barely manage to drag himself around the courtyard on two crutches, Kristin had heard. And yet she thought that even back then, she had not had bitter feelings toward Erland. She seemed to realize that for Erland,
The worst was still ahead when he became a free man. Then he had taken refuge with Abbot Olav. Tend to the moving or show himself in Nidaros now, that was more than Erland Nikolausen could bear. Then came the day when they sailed across Trondheim Fjord, on the Laurentius boat, the same ship on which Erland had transported all the belongings she had wanted to bring north with her after they had won permission to marry. A still day in late autumn, a pale, leaden gleam on the fjord, the whole world cold, restless, white-ribbed. The first snow blown into streaks along the frozen acres, the chill blue mountains white-striped with snow. Even the clouds high overhead, where the sky was blue, seemed to be scattered thin like flour by a high wind up in the heavens. Heavy and sluggish, the ship pulled away from the land, the town promontory. Kristen stood and watched the white spray beneath the cliffs, wondering if she was going to be seasick when they were farther out in the fjord. Erland stood at the railing close to the bow, with his two eldest sons behind him. The wind fluttered their hair and capes. Then they looked across Korsfjord, toward Gaularus and the skerries of Birgsey. A ray of sunlight lit up the brown and white slope along the shore. Erland said something to the boys. Then Björgulf abruptly turned on his heel, left the railing, and walked toward the stern of the ship. He fumbled along, using the spear that he always carried and used as a staff, as he made his way between the empty rowing benches and past his mother. His dark, curly head was bent low over his breast, his eyes squinting so hard they were nearly closed, his lips pressed tight. He walked under the afterdeck. Kristen glanced forward at the other two, Erland and his eldest son. Then Nikolaus knelt, the way a page does to greet his lord. He took his father's hand and kissed it. Erland tore his hand away. Kristen caught a glimpse of his face, pale as death and trembling, as he turned his back to the boy and walked away, disappearing behind the sail. They put in at a port down by Myrda for the night. The sea swells were more turbulent, the ship tugged at its ropes, rising and pitching. Kristen was below in the cabin where she was to sleep with Erland and the two youngest children. She felt sick to her stomach and couldn't find a proper foothold on the deck, which rose and fell beneath her feet. The skin-covered lantern swung above her head, its tiny light flickering. And she stood there struggling with Munan, trying to get him to pee in between the planks. Whenever he woke up, groggy with sleep, he would both pee and soil their bed, raging and screaming and refusing to allow this strange woman, his mother, to help him by holding him over the floor. Then Erland came below. She couldn't see his face when he asked in a low voice, "Did you see Nakva?" His eyes were just like yours, Kristen. Erland drew in a breath, quick and harsh. "That's the way your eyes looked on that morning out by the fence in the nun's garden, after you had heard the worst about me. And you pledged me your trust." That was the moment when she felt the first drop of bitterness rise up in her heart. God protect the boy. May he never see the day when he realizes that he has placed his trust in a hand that lets everything run through its fingers like cold water and dry sand. A few moments ago, she thought she heard distant hoofbeats somewhere on the mountain heights to the south. Now she heard them again, closer. Not horses running free, but a single horse and rider. He rode sharply over the rocky slopes beneath the hillside. Fear seized her, icy cold. Who could be traveling about so late? Dead men rode north under a waning moon. Didn't she hear the other horsemen accompanying the first one, riding far behind? And yet she stayed sitting where she was. She didn't know if this was because she was suddenly bewitched, or because her heart was so stubborn that night. The rider was coming toward her. Now he was fording the river beneath the slope. She saw the glint of a spear point above the willow thickets. Then she scrambled down from the boulder and was about to run back to the hut. The rider leaped from his horse, tied it to the gatepost, and threw his cape over its back. He came walking up the slope. He was a tall, broad man. Now she recognized him. It was Simon. When he saw her coming to meet him in the moonlight, he seemed to be just as frightened as she had been before.
Jesus, Kristen! Is that you? Or how is it that you're out at this time of night? Were you waiting for me?